Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The math on this one should have been pretty easy to figure out. Freddie Mac holds a huge chunk of this country's mortgage debt. The housing industry is in its biggest slump in a generation or more. So today's profit report by Freddie Mac was never going to be good. But I don't think anybody understood exactly how bad it was going to be. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 6th of August, Wednesday, and it is great to have you here as always. So how about almost $1 billion bad? For the fourth consecutive quarter, that's more than a year, just to make the point, Freddie Mac is deep in red ink, $842 million worth, three times as bad as even the pessimists had been guessing. With no sure sign the housing market's hit bottom yet, we asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out what might happen next for the government-backed mortgage giant.
Freddie Mac has lost more than $4.5 billion so far this year. The CEO's proposed solution? Raise $5.5 billion from investors. Chris Mayer studies real estate at Columbia. He says that could be tough, at least until the housing market sorts itself out and investors can see which way Freddie Mac is going.
Either things continue to get worse and their losses get to the point where they're really going to have to go to the government for some type of assistance, or things turn out to be better so that, you know, people start to believe that the losses aren't going to make them insolvent.
Mayer says that $5.5 billion Freddie Mac plans to raise is key. The longer the company goes without the cash, the uglier things will be. Karen Shaw-Petru is with Federal Financial Analytics. She says Freddie Mac will be around when it's all over. The question is how.
Whether it retains its GSE status as a publicly backed, privately owned company is the question, or instead, would it be turned into a receivership? In essence, will it be restructured?
She says Freddie Mac can't disappear altogether. The company was created nearly 40 years ago to help ordinary Americans buy homes. The law that spawned the company also guarantees it'll always exist in some form. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Of course, it's not just Freddie Mac that's got the government in the mortgage business. Fannie Mae could well be in just as much trouble. It reports profits Friday morning before the bell. The agribusiness giant Archer Daniels Midland saw profits plunge 61% last quarter. ADM is one of this country's biggest producers of ethanol. But in its earnings announcement yesterday, it said it's a little worried about the future of the corn-based fuel here in the United States. High corn prices are killing its margins. On top of that, the food crisis is complicating matters because governments are beginning to question incentives they're giving for alternative fuels made from crops. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports the changing agricultural landscape has ADM rethinking its strategy.
ADM is in a catch-22. The more corn ethanol it produces, the less profitable that ethanol becomes. Bruce Babcock is an agricultural economist at Iowa State University.
The expansion of the ethanol industry was their own worst enemy because it caused their number one cost of production, corn, to more than double in price.
Take ADM's most recent numbers. Revenue has nearly doubled in the past year to $22 billion last quarter. But with corn so expensive, profits have taken a nosedive. Chief Executive Patricia Wirtz said in a conference call that ADM may be looking in a new direction.
We have been interested and continue to stay interested in investment in sugar and ethanol processing in Brazil. And we have talked with several potential partners.
ADM owns a small percentage of Brazilian sugar ethanol producer Cosan. U.S. agribusiness is looking into Brazil for a simple reason. The country has more than 220 million acres of unused farmland. Paulo Sotero directs the Brazil Institute in Washington, D.C.
Those lands are near the production centers. Those lands are not in the Amazon. They are in what we call the Cerrado region, and it's natural that American companies be attracted to that.
The EPA is currently considering a request to cut federal mandates on corn ethanol in half, yet one more reason for ADM to diversify its business. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
One more profit report for you to blame on the slowing economy. The Postal Service announced today it lost $1.1 billion for the quarter ended in June. Officials blamed higher fuel costs and less mail being sent in lean economic times. It's down 5.5% from last year. Even though we usually do think of it as a government operation, the post office is a private company. And the same can be said for some prisons in this country. Most of them are government-run. But about 7% of the population behind bars is housed in prisons run by for-profit corporations. The biggest of those companies, Corrections Corporation of America, reports profits tomorrow. Like any other company, rising prices have raised its costs of doing business. And its customers, federal, state, and local governments, are facing tight budgets. Ashley Milne-Tite has this look at private prisons' prospects.
Private prison companies aren't too badly hit by the rising cost of food, for example, because they lock in prices in multi-year contracts with suppliers. Kevin Campbell is an equity analyst with Avondale Partners. He says private prisons' basic operating costs may be rising overall, but prisons could benefit from the state's financial problems.
Because budgets are tight, it's hard for states to commit to building their own new prisons, which then has the tendency to exacerbate the overcrowded problem and therefore increases demand for private sector beds.
And that demand doesn't show any sign of slowing. Sean Smith is an equity analyst with Zacks Investment Research.
The prison population has been growing over the last 10 years in the U.S. at about 3.5% annually. You know, the long-run demand picture is still there for the private prison companies.
He says the burgeoning number of prisoners is a depressing thought, unless you're an investor. Kevin Campbell says if a new administration decided to overhaul drug enforcement rules, prisoner numbers could decline, and revenues with them. And he says both Corrections Corporation of America and Arrival have done well lately by detaining illegal immigrants.
And that probably is, you know, 13 to 15% of their total revenues would be my guess. And so if there's some change in immigration enforcement policy, some relaxation of enforcement, that I think would be viewed as a negative as well.
Corrections Corporation of America's stock has gained more than 20% since February. Both analysts say it's a buy. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Traders took a breather after yesterday's rally. Still finished on the upside, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You can go online and get yourself a decent computer for maybe $500 or $600. But if you don't already have a computer, it's tough to get online. And if you don't have $500 or $600, then forget the whole thing. Today, a team at MIT's annual design competition announced plans for a computer that'll go for somewhere between $10 and $20, in part because it's going to use Nintendo technology from the 1980s. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
Super Mario is back. The star of the 80s computer game will be doing some traveling to countries like Ghana and India. The team at MIT is building its computer around a Nintendo-style console like the ones we used 20 years ago. Hopefully they'll lose the music. These consoles would plug into a computer keyboard, which would then plug into a TV. The international team creating the computer is at MIT for its annual design summit. Their advisor is Olin College engineer Ben Linder. He says this 80s technology could spawn new economic opportunities for people who've never even heard of Super Mario.
You know, instead of $2 a day, they could go to $2 an hour by doing office work that involves computers. That's a major change.
Linder says the consoles would be loaded with educational programs. These computers are for learning, not for working. Linder says old games could be modified for new users.
They're going to play a game, but in the process they're going to gain a bunch of typing skills and basic computing skills and familiarity with technology.
but it would be old technology, Jupiter Research computer industry analyst Michael Gartenberg.
Training people on obsolete systems doesn't necessarily help them going forward.
Professor Linder says the team's just at the idea stage right now. It hopes to update its computers, maybe taking Super Mario to another new place, the Internet. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Two days before the Olympics officially start, so have the protests. Today, police tore down a couple of Free Tibet banners that had been hung near the Bird's Nest Stadium. That's where the opening ceremony is going to be held on Friday. The official explanation was that the stadium's not an approved protest zone. The four foreigners, two Brits, two Americans, who hung the flags have been told they have to leave the country. But that leaves open the question of what Beijing's going to do with domestic dissidents during the Games. Commentator David Frum wonders whether a slumping Chinese economy might be just the ticket for a more open society.
According to the official figures, China's pace of economic growth dropped by 2 percentage points in the first 6 months of 2008. Chinese economic statistics always have to be taken with a bag of salt, but the trend seems clear. The slowdown in the rest of the world is beginning to squeeze the Chinese economy hard. China depends on international trade for up to 80% of its GDP. The United States is China's largest customer. As American demand for Chinese products declines, China's costs are rising. Higher fuel prices have pushed the cost of shipping a standard 40-foot container across the Pacific to $8,000, up from $3,000 at the beginning of the decade. Shippers are adapting by slowing their travel speeds. Bad news for Chinese suppliers in a just-in-time world economy. Raw material costs are rising, too. China imports the iron for its steel, the fertilizer for its crops, the coal for its electricity. China is a low-value-added economy. One famous study found that of the $299 cost of an assembled-in-China iPod, only $4 was retained in China. This is not a country with a lot of margin for error. When the U.S. economy slows, Americans can respond politically. We blame the incumbent president, and on Election Day, we replace him with a new one. Long before we lose confidence in the replacement, the economy has almost certainly turned around. The average length of post-World War II recessions in the United States is only 11 months. China lacks that safety valve. Leaders are unelected. Dissent is strictly limited. Since the Tiananmen Square massacre of 1989, China's leaders have offered their people growth and prosperity instead of freedom and accountability. That bargain has endured for almost two decades. But if the leaders can no longer deliver, will the people continue to submit?
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. His latest book is called Comeback, Conservatism That Can Win Again. Your thoughts come back to us best online. Marketplace.org is the website. Contact is the link you need to look for. To some degree, the Olympics are all about speed. The fastest time, the quickest lap, the shortest sprint, which fits right in a place like China where the pace of change can be dizzying. But really, how fast is fast? From Shanghai Marketplace's Scott Tong reports on one enterprising economist who's actually tried to measure it.
Just about everyone in Shanghai has an anecdote about how quickly things change here. Did you hear about that new restaurant or skyscraper or billionaire? Here's a for instance from Stephen Green.
7 years ago, there was not a single Porsche or BMW on the streets. Now, you know, every time you cross the road, you're almost killed by one.
Green is an economist with Standard Chartered Bank, and he's developed a yardstick to try to measure China's speed. He takes GDP per capita. It's rocketed from a measly $56 per person in 1980 to $2,000 today. That growth rate is his economic speedometer.
On average, it's like living four times as fast when you move to China. So if you spend 10 years in China, that's the equivalent of living 40 years in Europe or the US.
Or think of the pace of your life as a movie. Say the infamous shower scene from Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. This would be normal speed. And this would be China speed. The scary fast pace of China creates business opportunities for folks who can keep up with it all. The startup company Eno sells streetwear. Its Shanghai stores host regular parties for the under 20 crowd. People like Momo Chen.
Kanye West, this eyes.
I remember Kanye West-style glasses. They got real popular around the world, and then a week later they were big in Shanghai. But then they went out within a month.
Once Eno spots a trend in design, say a T-shirt, company founder Tor Peterson can have it on store shelves within 3 weeks. Peterson is also in a hurry to open new stores. He says there's a retail land grab going on all across China.
So it's really all about just getting out there and competing for those locations. Everybody's doing that really fast. As an example, Nike's opening at least a store a day, if not two stores a day in China today.
It's all dizzying, but keep in mind a couple things. First, not everyone in China experiences the crackle and pop of Shanghai. In fact, 800 million people still live in the countryside. And this frenetic pace can create anxiety. 22-year-old grad student Edward Cheng wonders how long this boom can last.
Is this wealth explosion kind of a bubble? Is it going to be bursted somehow in 3 years? I have this kind of worry.
Still, many economists like Stephen Green think China can keep hurtling ahead. He says it's not far-fetched to assume 8% growth for the next 20 years. Now, remember, that's 20 years at China pace on Fast Forward. In the blur of Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, making heaps of money from piles of sawdust.
This has transitioned from a waste product, a byproduct, to a real commodity. That is the turning point that we're at right now, which we think is a very good thing.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed a third of 1%, 40 points today, to close at 11,656. The Nasdaq shot up 1.2%, 28 points, to finish at 2378. The S&P 500 improved a third of a percent, 4 points, ended the day at 1289. We told you about Freddie Mac's huge second quarter loss and bleak outlook. Shares in the mortgage financier tumbled more than 19% today. Its sibling company, Fannie Mae, plunged almost 15%. Networking equipment maker Cisco boosted the tech sector with a strong quarterly profit. Cisco stock ticked up 5.2%. Microsoft jumped 3% on news that the tech giant may buy back as much as $20 billion worth of its own stock. Polo Ralph Lauren galloped 7% higher today. Brisk European sales helped the apparel company post higher than expected profits. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.05%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about business at Gather.com. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. President Bush meets with Burma activists in Bangkok, Thailand. The Federal Reserve Board releases its consumer credit report for June. And on this day in 1959, the U.S. launched Satellite Explorer 6. It was the first probe to transmit pictures of Earth from space. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It has been a brisk couple of weeks in the commodities markets, mostly on the sell side, and not just oil either. Prices for everything from soybeans and corn to aluminum and copper are well off the highs they hit earlier this year. To find out why and to find out what might happen next, we've called John Authors. He's the investment editor at the Financial Times. Mr. Authors, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
Oil gets all the headlines, of course, but what else has been going on in commodities this past year or so?
At one point, food prices had actually increased even more than oil. And you also had a big rise in a lot of the more obscure commodities, things that you or I may not totally understand their uses, such as cobalt is one of my favorites, which more than doubled in price at one point. You saw across the board increases in agricultural products and metals, as well as in energy. And there's been a number of financial innovations which have meant that a lot of money is coming into commodities purely as an investment that wasn't coming in there, say, 5 years ago.
When you say purely as an investment, is there a subtext there of speculation or no?
There's a subtext there of speculation, if you want to call that a pejorative term. I suppose there's some reason for doing that. There are good academic reasons behind it for the large pension funds. There was a lot of research suggesting that commodities are what's known as a diversifier, that they weren't correlated with stocks and bonds, so you could get the same returns for less risk. The big argument against that is that you built your evidence that they would behave that way at a point when people weren't treating it like an investment, that they were being bought and sold by farmers, oil producers to manage their risk. In the last 6 months, people got scared about what was happening in stocks. They got worried about inflation, and so they piled into commodities, particularly oil. And of course, when you do that, you actually become more of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Inflation will go up if the price of oil goes up.
Mm-hmm. And what about those people who are just getting into commodities now, whose pension funds are just now turning to it, or who are investing for themselves and just turning to it? Mm. Are they late to the party?
Probably. There are two different arguments about this. One is that it's an argument that goes back to a guy called Kondratiev, a Bolshevik revolutionary who did, however, have a theory that is still accepted by many capitalists, that commodities go in very long cycles. If that's the case, then the very sharp falls we've seen in the last few weeks may just be a correction to some speculative excess, and we'll move forward. If that's the case, then people who've got in recently won't be hurt. Listeners probably aren't going to feel terribly sorry for them, but in terms of the damage it could cause to the financial system, the most worrying thing would be hedge fund managers. A lot of hedge funds were betting on oil to keep going up, and they were possibly doing that with borrowed money. Therefore, if they've had these kinds of losses, that might mean that they need to start selling other things to be able to make good their losses.
If this is the end of the commodities boom, what happens next? What's the ripple effect?
Most important ripple effect would be a positive one, which is that commodities are a very important part of inflation. If we don't have to worry about fighting inflation, it becomes easier to fight against the possible deflationary effects of all the problems we have in housing and credit. The one issue is still one of conjecture for the time being, is that a number of the bigger emerging economies that export commodities have very strong, possibly overvalued currencies, thanks to the kind of money they've had flowing in. Countries like Brazil is often cited as an example. Whether this could lead, if we have a really sudden and permanent fall in commodity prices, what effect it could have on some of those bigger emerging markets is another important issue.
John Authors is the investment editor at the Financial Times. Mr. Authors, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Even if you don't read the financial news all that closely, you can probably name at least a couple of commodities right off the top of your head, right? I bet sawdust didn't come to mind. Most of us probably think of it as something to sweep into the garbage after the sawing's done. But demand has grown enormously, as Vermont Public Radio's Nina Keck reports. With wood manufacturing and construction down due to the housing slump, sawdust is at a premium.
Gagnon Lumber in Pittsford, Vermont, produces between 25 to 30 tons of sawdust a week. Underneath the saws, a conveyor belt carries a steady stream of the sweet-smelling remnants to a huge pile, Owner Ken Gagnon says he sells most of it to area farmers.
The sawmill business and agricultural farming have been hand in hand through history. So it's made, there's always been a market for a certain amount of sawdust, whatever the farmers could use for his cows.
But sawdust has come a long way from its use as a cushy barn bed. Landscapers and gardeners like it for mulch, while meat smokers use it as an aromatic flavoring. Finally, ground sawdust is a lightweight filler in many plastic products. It's used to make particle and fiberboard, and it's become a valuable renewable fuel source in the form of wood pellets. Charlie Niebling runs a wood pellet plant in Jaffrey, New Hampshire.
With heating oil approaching $5 a gallon, people are genuinely concerned and anxious. A lot of people are thinking seriously about alternatives now.
Niebling says he can't make pellets fast enough. But while demand for wood byproducts is at an all-time high, supplies are down. Ken Gagnon and mill owners across the country blame the drop in construction.
We've been going through a correction for pretty near, well, it's going on 2 years here on our level, so we're actually not producing as much lumber as we could, which has an indirect effect on how much sawdust that we make.
But if sawdust is so precious, I ask Gagnon, why not just make more of it? For now, he says, even in the middle of a housing slump, it's still more profitable to mill lumber.
It may come to a time where the byproducts are going to be the saving grace of the lumber industry. I think the housing business will come back, but I really see that the byproducts, primarily the biofuels, whether it's sawdust or chips, will be a big part of things to come.
Chris Recchia thinks that's already happening. Recchia is executive director of the Biomass Energy Research Center.
This has transitioned from a waste product, a byproduct, to a real commodity. That is the turning point that we're at right now, which we think is a very good thing.
Because, Recchia says, it's encouraging better use of resources. Typically, when loggers finish a job, they'll leave behind a lot of low-grade cuttings not suitable for lumber. Now that wood byproducts are fetching a higher price, loggers can process and sell what they used to consider waste wood to people like Charlie Niebling of New England Wood Pellet.
We are purchasing material from logging contractors who harvest this low-grade material that otherwise has little value, take the bark off of it for us, chip it, and send the chips to us. That simply wasn't possible 3 or 4 years ago.
Niebling says in their company, the term waste wood no longer exists. In Chittenden, Vermont, I'm Nina Keck for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, and I don't really know how to tell you this, but Mr. Bubble is dead. The brand who made kids' baths bubbly for decades passed away yesterday due to complications from falling sales and rising costs. Also deceased are his cousins Calgon Bath and Body Products and Banaka Breath Freshener. Parent company Ascendia Brands announced their passing yesterday in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy filing. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow plumped up 40 points, a third of 1%. The NASDAQ rose 28 points, 1.2%. The S&P 500 packed on 4 points. That's about a third of a percent there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, metal scavengers find treasure in the trash.
They pull out file cabinets, pipes and pumps, springs and sprockets, and even nails and screws.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.